U.S. agents as part of our country's disgraceful attack on human rights, civil rights, and the rule of law. And for now, that's it. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!
To KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Hey KBOO listeners, Willamette Week is seeking nominations for their annual Best of Portland Readers Poll, and we need your help to show Portland what KBOO means to this community. From now through noon on Friday, April 25th, you can nominate us for Best Radio Station. Just head to kboo.fm and click the Best of Portland banner to submit your nomination. Thank you for supporting your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Tune in to KBOO on April 22nd at 10 a.m. for Rockin' Out with DJ Fluorite, a part of KBOO's special Earth Day programming. This program is dedicated to geology in honor of Earth Day, so tune in to learn about rocks while listening to rock. You won't want to miss it. That's Rockin' Out with DJ Fluorite on April 22nd at 10 a.m., only on KBOO.
This is Bobby Seale here. I'm the former chairman, founder, and the old national organizer of the Black Panther Party. The Black Panther Party is a political revolutionary organization out of the 1960s. This is Hard Knock Radio. I love Hard Knock Radio. Coming here and listening to this framework here, it's what's happening. You've got to be tuned in. And I want all people who dig Hard Knock to understand that you can do some hard knock work out there in the community, Jim.
On the move, this is Pam Africa on Hard Knock Radio, the station of resistance. Down with this rotten ass system. Stay tuned to Hard Knock Radio.
You know what this is called? Stereotype.
Target Corporation, America's retail darling, has survived several scandals because of its cozy relationship with the corporate media apparatus.
And so Safe Zone, it started the downtown surveillance program, but eventually the Safe Zone grew into a massive citywide surveillance program called Safe Cities that ended up spreading to 25 cities across the U.S.
For the past year, Unicorn Riot and the People Power Podcast have partnered to bring you the scathing report, 21st Century Jim Crow and the North Star City, detailing Target's deep investments in policing, racialized surveillance, and mass incarceration in Minneapolis.
So Minneapolis being this model city, it really, we saw innovation in not just surveillance technology, but, you know, we saw the growth of human surveillance programs through the Downtown 100, which is essentially a criminal registry that is compiled of the top 100 so-called offenders in downtown Minneapolis.
None of this would be achieved without denying the voices of Black youths and adults in downtown.
So you go to the Marriott downtown or the City Center or Target, all of these people know your record. Your name, since you're down to 100, your name goes right to the place and they'll be like, oh, we don't want you here. We recognize you type stuff like that.
We used to just go down there just to hang out. We really didn't have nothing to do. Four officers walk up and they approached us and asked us what the f*** was we doing downtown and just kind of got to harassing us. And we said we wasn't doing nothing wrong, so they came and walked up on us and said they'll take us to jail and said they'll Trayvon Martin our little black asses, was his exact words. And I asked him, what do you mean by that? You'll kill us? He said, if that's the way you take it. And my friends automatically just said, get on the bus, get on the bus. They kind of been harassing me ever since then.
It was a surveillance program that was, it was sold to the public as a diversion program, but really, it was a pipeline from the streets to prison.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. A few weeks ago, a lot of people became very upset with the corporation, the retail outlet Target, who announced pretty boldly and widely that they would be rescinding any diversity in equity and inclusion initiatives. We saw that the store that kind of had garnered a reputation for displaying different types of or celebrating different ethnicities and different months that had themes that centered around underrepresented populations, Women's History Month, Hispanic History Month, Black History Month, all those things were going to go to the wayside. And that caused a lot of uproar. There were some folks who added to the controversy because they were black or brown and had fought long and hard to get their products into Target, and they were kind of saying, don't boycott them because it's going to hurt us. Other people were saying, enough's enough. Let's go really in on Target. And so as we are in the middle of Black History Month, there are a lot of people who have really pointed out that there will be no shopping at Target. Many of us who are on social media were bombarded with the feeds, but one day I got a feed from a gentleman, a freelance journalist, and he brought attention to Target and really unearthed some facts that many of us did not know. He had authored a 12-part series about the Target Corporation called The 21st Century, Jim Crow and the North Star City. A lot of it was penned several years ago, right around the George Floyd uprising, but I would encourage people to really take a look at that report. It can be found in Unicorn Riot. So joining us this afternoon to break down what is going on with Target on a much deeper level is Minneapolis school teacher and freelance journalist, Majan MJ Sidar. I wish I could have seen the look on your face when people came out and said, we need to boycott Target. Knowing all the information that you had and a lot of what I read, I was like, wow, I don't know if you were waiting for this moment, if you were surprised, or you were just like, if you think the store is bad, wait until you hear this information. So I'll start off with that, and then we can get into what Target has really been about.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. It's an honor, Davey D. And I would say the latter part. You know, when I heard that people were starting to boycott Target and the tide was finally starting to turn, my initial reaction was, wait until you hear, you know, what I got to tell you. And so a friend of mine, Aaron Johnson, he's a local Minneapolis activist and documentarian, hit me up and he wanted to interview me outside of Target's East Lake Street store, which is the famous store that was looted after the police precinct was burnt down across the street after George Floyd's murder. And so Aaron, you know, he's followed my work at Unicorn Riot, my 12-part series, and he wanted me to really go to break down, you know, what Target has really been doing and a lot of the harm they've caused our communities over the decades. And so I thought it was a perfect opportunity to let people know that Target deserves more scrutiny.
So one of the things that stood out, and I guess you cover this, I mean, throughout the 12-part series, but you jump knee deep into this in the first two, and of course your initial report that I saw online, the updated one where you did the interviews, what caught my attention was the surveillance that Target participates in, the facial recognition. And for people that are listening and saying, well, we're in the Bay Area, what does Minneapolis have to do with us? What I garnered and what concerned me was that Target is a template that has already been followed or being uploaded by people and corporations all around the country. More concerning is this private public type of interaction that Target has. So I guess just to kind of sum it up, if the police find their hands tied, they don't have to worry. They have Target. Target can do all the dirty work. And I think we kind of see that now with what is happening with Elon Musk and other folks who coming from the private sector and been able to use their vast private sector to do basically public work that is out of reach for most of us to contain or to scrutinize or to hold accountable. That's what I garnered from a lot of what I've read, but I'll let you take the floor. Maybe you can start breaking down and starting with the mass surveillance that Target participates in.
Yes, you know, so government resources are limited, right? So government for decades has tapped the private sector to fill in a lot of gaps. And so, like you had mentioned, law enforcement has been, they've been going to Target for more than two decades now. So in around 2003, Target built two state-of-the-art crime labs. And I'm talking about world-class crime labs, one here in the Twin Cities and another one in Las Vegas. And Target has opened up their crime labs to law enforcement to access for free. So we're not just talking about local police, we're talking about the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, Department of Homeland Security, ICE. And so Target's crime lab.
Let me ask you this, MJ. They built a crime lab for Target, or they built a crime lab for local police department?
Well, for both. Initially it was for Target, but you know, through my research, what I realized is, you know, it was to help bolster its loss prevention program, catch shoplifters. But in order to do that, Target needed assistance from law enforcement, right? And so local police here in Minneapolis and throughout metropolitans across the country, they're not focused on petty shoplifting, right? So Target, in order to get the police's assistance, they had to offer something, right? So Target built this state-of-the-art crime lab for Target employs forensics experts and, you know, in video analysis and in all kinds of areas. And so Target quickly became a leader in this field, and Target began training police, federal law enforcement officials, and even law enforcement agencies overseas internationally. So Target quickly became a leader in the field of forensics, but also in the field of surveillance. And so by opening up its forensics labs to law enforcement, Target was able to become a frequent partner and collaborator with police and feds across the country in cracking crime and trying to solve cases. And we're talking about beyond shoplifting, right? So Target, more than 25% of the work that gets done in its crime labs have nothing to do with shoplifting, have nothing to do with Target stores.
That's the voice of a freelance journalist from Unicorn Riot. His name is MJ Sadar, and we're talking to him about the 12-part series that he did on the Target Corporation. It was something that was written before there were calls to boycott Target for eliminating DEI policies. I want to come back to the surveillance thing, because they were gung-ho in this, especially with facial recognition technology, and it raises a lot of questions that you bring up in your report, in your series. I guess the one thing is, if I read everything correctly, was that getting the police to have facial recognition technology was going to be a long road to climb, but Target could do it and did do it. And then alongside that, we start to see, and I think you alluded to that they were funding the campaigns and pretty much, in my opinion, owned the district attorney, as you mentioned, funding the police. And also part of a larger narrative, which I think is important, is eradicating or helping get rid of undesirable populations, quotations around the word undesirable, to bring in new residents into the city. And you talked about the housing boom and what's going on in Minneapolis, and Target has been front and center in that. So there's a lot of things. I mean, on one hand, it's like, yay, they got a black retailer and they have black displays, but everything they're doing off record is anti-black to the core, is what I gathered. Did I misunderstand this in your reports?
No, you're right on. You're right on. And so in the early 2000s, Target began funding the county attorney's office. And what they did was they wanted our prosecutors to go after some of the lowest level offenders in downtown Minneapolis, as you said, because they wanted to attract a certain population to the downtown core. And these were, you know, what they call young corporate professionals, which really is suburban educated white folks to come work for these Fortune 500 companies, as we often see.
We used to call them yuppies back in the 90s.
Yeah, exactly.
Same thing now. Hipsters, then it became hipsters, and now there's something else.
Right. Yeah, and that's who, you know, that's who Target's base is, right? Its base is suburban white folks. And so in order to attract this population to move downtown and to work at Target's global headquarters in downtown Minneapolis, they employed our police force and our prosecutors to so-called clean up downtown, right? To mostly go after street populations. So we're talking about black youths, we're talking about homeless populations. And again, it was to target some of the lowest level offenders. Downtown Minneapolis, it must be said that our downtown is one of the safest neighborhoods in the city, you know, probably the second or third safest. Low crime, most of the crime that happens in downtown is theft, right? Because it's our central business district, but very low violent crime. And so what they did was, you know, again, they paid for a prosecuting attorney and a paralegal to specifically go after offenders that were committing these weren't even really crimes, they were violations, they were ordinances, things like jaywalking, littering, open drug consumption, yeah. Drinking in public, stuff like that, urinating in public, stuff that you would typically get a citation for. And so what Target did was they started, you know, calling for zero tolerance prosecution and sending a lot of these folks to jail. And so around the same time, they donated a surveillance camera system to the downtown district, to the city of Minneapolis, to help law enforcement and to help prosecutors catch, you know, these offenders, to make it easier to prosecute folks that were committing what they called livability crimes, right? And so livability crime, again, it's really a non-crime. It's, you know, graffiti, right? Graffiti on the wall, things that they claim were making downtown unlivable or less desirable.
Right. Well, they used to call it the broken window theory.
That's right.
And the way that was supposed to work is if I catch you doing something small, we already have a paper trail when you do something big. So it's not one, your first offense when you do something big, because we got you on all these little things. And if I make things hot and uncomfortable with just picking out these small crimes, it's going to be a deterrent and you're going to go away. And I'm sure Target might claim that it's because of this broken window theory they put into action that your downtown is safe, one of the safer ones in this country versus some other areas.
Right. And so broken windows, people, you know, your listeners need to know that broken windows has been debunked as racist, right, to its core. And so broken windows is a theory that was created by law enforcement experts that said that, you know, if law enforcement focuses on the most minor crimes, it could prevent some of the greater violent crimes. It could prevent atrocities. And this has never been proven to be true, right? And so this Safe City initiative that was created by Target, which is their hallmark mass surveillance project, was rooted in the broken windows theory, right? So if we can go after, you know, winos and drug users on the street, people who need support, right? People who need services, people who need rehabilitation, not incarceration. But if we go after those folks, we can reduce the violent crime or prevent the violent crime from happening. And so they created a massive network of law enforcement, of private security guards, of social service workers, of business leaders, to surveil and track, you know, these downtown populations, these so-called undesirable populations, to really push them out, drive them out of the downtown, and move homelessness to other parts of the city. And so what we ended up seeing over the course of that decade from, you know, 2000 to 2010 was the creation of a program that they called the Downtown 100. And so the Downtown 100, on its face, it was an offenders list of the top 100, you know, so-called criminals in downtown Minneapolis, some of the most people who had who had racked up the most offenses. That's, you know, that was the program on its face, and it was to target these individuals and to reduce recidivism and to funnel them either to jail or to divert them to social services, because they knew most of these folks were homeless folks, right? And so again, on its face, that's what the program was. It had some what we would acknowledge were admirable goals, right? To get some of these folks housed, to get some of these folks in treatment. Well, again, as we peel back some of the layers, what we saw was that wasn't the case at all. And this program, it really became a feeder program from the streets to prison, again, for vulnerable populations, people who needed support, who needed services. And, you know, its record of housing these people and getting people into treatment successfully was very low. There was not very much, and still is not very much affordable housing for people anywhere, but especially people coming out of homelessness. And so this list, the Downtown 100 list, actually was not a list of the top 100 offenders. What it was it was a list of people who had the most contacts with police. And mm-hmm. and that's a big difference, right? Because again, many listeners at home are like, okay, you know, locking up the top 100 offenders isn't a bad thing. People might say to themselves, but you know, as we examine this program and what was really going on, these were young people who had police contact, meaning that police had the discretion to target and to harass folks. And what police would do was they were tracking, they had a system to track, you know, who they were coming in contact with, even though they weren't arresting or citating, giving citations to these folks, right?
And so that sounds like, not to interrupt, that sounds mm-hmm. like if we were to look at New York City's policy or the policy they had, I believe, in Pittsburgh, which was stop and frisk. That's well, right. That 90% of the stop and frisk was concentrated in a few areas. And I mean, we're talking about thousands of people being stopped or thousands of stops being made. People would often get stopped multiple times in these stop and frisk things. And yet, at the end of the day, it yielded less than 10% weapons and drugs or whatever it was that they were looking for. But if we go by that, there were stories of, you know, husbands and wives and kids being stopped sometimes 5-6 times by police, which would put them on that thing. So you never got arrested, but you had contact. Would that have been kind of similar? I don't know if Minneapolis or the Twin Cities had a stop and frisk type of thing, but when you talk about contact, I would imagine that would be part of that record. Like, yeah, we contacted Dave and we contacted him again and we contacted him three more times. We didn't find nothing, but he has six contacts with police, which obviously, as you point out, seem to be something that is weaponized.
Yep, and you're exactly right. Minneapolis, just like New York and Pittsburgh and some of the other major metropolitans, our police force also use stop and frisk as a tool to target and to harass so-called undesirable populations. And we're talking about a hyper-focus on Black youth, street youth, right? And so stop and frisk it's a surveillance tool, right? So we're talking about layers to the surveillance. So there was surveillance technology in the form of cameras, walkie-talkies that network police, private security guards, social service workers. You had the human surveillance, right? You had snitches, police informants, folks, you know, business partners who kept a watchful eye out on downtown. And mm-hmm. all of this information was being funneled to the police and to the prosecutor's office, which again was controlled by Target, right? And so, yes, stop and frisk is an important part of this story of what was happening, because, you know, they were targeting young men that I worked with. Right. So at the time, when a lot of this was going down, I was actually working for a downtown nonprofit and we were providing services to homeless youth. Right. I was a case manager. I ran a young Black men's group. And so in our weekly group, you know, which, you know, let me let y'all know that we created this young Black men's group because the Black youth that I work with asked for a place, a safe place to come talk about the harassment by cops and the racism that they were experiencing in downtown Minneapolis as they left the shelters in the morning and were, you know, basically put on the streets to walk the streets all day until shelters open back up at night, right? So I worked for, it was a daytime drop-in center where they could come, they could take showers, they can get meals, and they could get counseling. And so I would hear these stories of these young men being harassed by the police, being threatened by the police, being searched for no reason at all, just for being, just for frequenting downtown and being, you know, caught on these surveillance cameras and becoming known To a lot of these businesses, especially Target. And I'm not going to say, you know, these young men, they never admitted that they were angels. They were homeless, you know. So much of the things they were doing that got them in trouble was shoplifting. They, you know, many of them were committing what we call crimes of survival, right? They, you know, selling drugs, smoking weed, drinking in public. But again, very, very little violent crime, right? Theft, stealing phones from folks. And the problem with this narrative is not all of the young people that I work with, not all of the young people downtown were involved in this, right? There were some, but the police used that to really sweep the street population in a massive dragnet, surveillance dragnet, to really target all of them and say that you know, these folks are making it unsafe and making it unpleasant for people to work and shop in downtown Minneapolis.
Right. MJ Sidar, I'm sorry,
Sidar
is our guest this afternoon, talking about the work that he's done in a 12-part series called 21st Century Jim Crow in North Star City. You can read it on Unicorn Ride, talking about the Target Corporation, and much of what he's talking about predates the call to boycott Target because of them removing DEI policies. One of the most fascinating chapters that I read in the series involves the clothing of Target stores, and for me it seemed like a vindication. We've had Target here close a couple of their stores, and immediately those closures were weaponized, not only weaponized, but they were broadcast all around the world. You know, Oakland has more closures, and the narrative is that it's just too much crime. And I thought to myself, well, wait a second, the stores that closed were the Target stores that were made for these young urban professionals that were supposed to move in these fancy buildings, the fancy buildings that I saw in your article seem pretty similar to the fancy buildings that they built here in Oakland, right? With the same goals in mind. And when I first heard about these store closings before these, you know, in other areas, because they closed in other areas, they said there just wasn't enough traffic, you know, that people were like, why should I go to a small Target in my building when I can go to the big Target, you know, down the street, you know? So the big Targets haven't closed, but these small ones did. But the headline was theft and yada, yada, yada. And then you pulled up the data and you was like, nah, the math ain't mathing, as they like to say. Let's talk a little bit about that, because I think also embedded in that article was the fact of what perception means to people. And so the perception here was that crime is out of control. We see these videos, we hear the stories, and you know, and they recalled the mayor and they recalled the prosecutor in two cities. It's talking about they're not tough on crime, and with retailers saying, yeah, things are just not right, when there's a much, much bigger story at hand. So I'll let you take the floor on that, MJ.
There is a much bigger story at hand. And so here in Minneapolis, Target also opened up one of those little, you know, kind of those urban boutique, smaller versions of Target in Uptown. And Uptown is a, you know, it's kind of a trendy community. It's been gentrified over the years. And it's kind of a Minneapolis's hipster community. And so, you know, they ended up shuttering that store, I think year before last, and it was due to foot traffic. It just wasn't making the sales that they had hoped and anticipated. And also, folks, I'm sure, you know, Target customers know, these stores weren't cheap, right? Target originally came onto the scene as a discount retailer, and over the course of the last decade or two, prices at Target have gone up, and especially at these little boutique stores. So people, you know, living in these communities realize they can get these stuff, that the goods that are offered at these little boutique Targets for cheaper at other places, right? Mm-hmm. And so at the same time, what we saw, you know, during around the time of the murder of George Floyd and the pandemic, we saw Target claiming a huge uptick in shrink or in theft, right? Huge. And their numbers, you know, were quite incredible. Like you said, the math was not math. And, you know, Target claims in 1 year, theft doubled from, you know, under $500 million to almost $1 billion just in 12 months, right? And every year it kept going up. Target executives are claiming that, you know, it's on track to shoot up more than $1 billion.
Let me hold you right there, MJ. Mm-hmm. I want to come back to this $93 billion figure. And you talked about with Target alone, they're talking about $1 billion, $500 million, et cetera, et cetera. Most of what we've seen are people going in and grabbing things that are now locked up. Soap powder, toothbrushes, things like that. So if I go to Target the other day, you know, you might see, you know, all these toiletry items locked up. You talked about just alone a $500 million. That's a hell of a lot of toothpaste that you got to be stealing.
I mean, over $1 billion now.
Over $1 billion. So
just Target stores.
Right. So that would be a stream of traffic of people walking in with bags and walking straight out, because a lot of businesses don't even make that much money. If we're talking about, you know, you'd have to have long lines and consistent stream of traffic with everybody just buying a lot of things. And it's going to be more than toiletries, right? So if you're in Target, you're buying, you know, furniture, you know, back to school stuff. There's a lot of things. But we're seeing, you know, Joe, you know, with his disheveled self walking in there with a plastic bag and coming out with some soap powder and some toiletries that then, you know, often get sold on the street corner somewhere. That ain't $1 billion worth of stuff. So this right. seems to be either something else is going on, like entire warehouses are being robbed, which becomes a whole other story, or as you said, a lot of inflation with people going, look, that guy, you know, who stole those toothbrushes, he's caused $1 billion in theft.
Right. You know, so let's break down these numbers a little bit. So as you said, $93 billion number, that represents all of theft across the country and in all retail outlets. So for Target to claim more than $1 billion alone, they're claiming more than 1% of all retail theft happens in Target stores. So if we take $1 billion, we divide it by 2,000 Target stores, that amounts to $500,000 in theft a year per store. And if we break that down per day, that's over $1,400 per day per store that's happening. It's an incredible number, right? And so What we realize is that
with a store that has this top notch surveillance, absolutely, and top of the line crime labs, and we can't forget that part.
That's right. That's exactly why it's such an incredible statistic that Target is putting out here, because Target has state of the art surveillance. They have their surveillance is more sophisticated than your local law enforcement technology, right? And they work closely with law enforcement. So nobody's walking out of Target with felony level goods. You know, if anything, what Target does is they will track you. So if you go into Target, you steal some deodorant, some toothbrush, some toothpaste, they're gonna tally that. And when you come back and you steal more stuff and it amounts to a felony level case, that's when they're going to stop you and that's when they're going to arrest you. So Target lets people steal small items from its stores until it amounts to a felony level case, and that's when it works with prosecutors and police to in Target. They do the in-house investigative work. They build the case and then they hand off that case to police and prosecutors when it reaches a felony level. So you know, for Target to claim it's losing $500,000, more than $500,000 per store per year. It's an insane amount of theft, and it's just not credible, considering Target's sophisticated surveillance tracking systems. Target has what they call graze trackers hidden inside their shelves. So if you stand in front of a shelf too long, it flags a shopper as somebody who could be potentially stealing, right? And it alerts its security forces inside the store, and they start monitoring you, right? And actually, not just inside the store. Target has dozens of investigative centers across the country. So they might have somebody in Cincinnati, Ohio, monitoring Oakland Target store, right? Their surveillance technology is super sophisticated, right? They boasted in the media how Target can they could read the credit card numbers on your credit card at checkout through their surveillance camera, right? They can read the time on your watch through their surveillance camera. So Target, they have files on you. They have files on your children, who you take inside their store. So for them to say that, you know, all of this crime is happening, what we realize is they're creating a crime panic, right? And they're doing it. It appears that Target is laundering this data right at the time where we saw their sales going down, right at the time where we saw certain stuff that's sitting on their shelves not selling, right? And so shrink, what people should know is shrink is a number, and retailers use that to push a crime narrative to say, you know, we're losing all this merchandise to theft. But shrink also includes merchandise that is damaged in stores due to whatever reason. It could be employees breaking stuff. That number also includes theft by employees, right? And so what we've learned as we unpack these numbers, most theft across the country, not just in Target, but in all retailers, is done by employees. And if we're going to go even deeper, there's more wage theft happening. So there's more theft occurring by the retailers themselves, stealing wages from their staff, which exceeds that $93 billion in shoplifting. So wage theft is actually the biggest form of theft. If we take shoplifting, if we take robberies on the street, all of that combined, it doesn't even amount to the dollars that corporations are stealing from their employees, right? But I one thing I just want to add is I could show you an article from 20 years ago where Target was, they were talking about organized crime rings coming in and stealing stuff from their stores across the country. So for more than 20 years, Target has really been manipulating this crime panic, this narrative, trying to blame a lot of this on organized crime rings. So they jump from you know, your petty theft by homeless population stealing deodorant, toothpaste, to organized crime rings who are coming in and stealing mass amounts of stuff and then going and selling it in flea markets. And so it's a convenient narrative that keeps, you know, keeps people focused on petty crime and street crime and organized crime, and it distracts people from really scrutinizing what these retailers are really doing.
MJ, in this 12-part series, Jim Crow in North Star City, 21st Century Jim Crow, you detail that this surveillance system is not just limited to Target, right? That there's a network. So, in other words, if I walk into the Target that's down here in Emeryville, where I'm at, and I go and steal, or someplace in Minneapolis, we use your city, and I go, you know, up the road or walk down the street or whatever, they have a series of cameras that is able to, like, well, Dave left here, he went over here, he went down the street, he went over here. So not only are they tracking you if you keep coming back to the store, you know, they have this line of sight, so to speak, that they can be, yeah, we saw him get into his gray car, and here's the license plate, because we got top of the line security.
Right.
And so, in other words, you're not really going to be able to get away unless, as you pointed out, I'm letting you get away. You know, that I'm letting you get to a point where we can have a solid case, and then we can put you away for long periods of time, which then comes down to this other question. Since they have backed the campaigns and have an office, you know, tough on crime prosecutors and all these other things, how many people have they put away, and are they still claiming $1 billion, you know, $1 billion worth of theft, or at least in the Twin Cities, $1 million worth of theft? Because you got all the pieces in place. You got the surveillance, you got the police, you got the tough on crime prosecutor. So what's, is this still an issue?
Right. And you're absolutely right. So target surveillance goes beyond its stores, right? So yes. in Minneapolis and
downtown. That's what caught me in your report, was that you were showing this. Like they're big brother.
That's right. And so they created a program that started in Minneapolis, in downtown Minneapolis. They called it Safe Zone. But it expanded to more than 25 cities within a year. It was in more than a dozen cities, and within a few years it was in more than two dozen cities. And so in Minneapolis, it started with a sophisticated network of surveillance cameras to monitor the downtown district where Target's global headquarters are located. In other cities, it might be surveillance cameras, or it might be other sophisticated technology that Target donated to its local law enforcement. But what we saw was, in the early 2000s, Target wanted to expand its business model. Prior to, you know, 9/11, most Targets were in suburbs across America, or in rural parts, right? And so they wanted to expand its market into the urban core, into the urban center. But in order for Target to do that, they made deals with local municipalities, such as Minneapolis, that in order for us to expand our stores into your city, into the urban parts of your city, we need tough on crime initiatives. So they made these deals with local police and prosecutors. And part of that exchange was Target donating equipment to municipalities, to law enforcement, to go after some of the lowest level offenders. We're not talking about murderers or violent criminals.
Or even crime families that are supposed to be at the core of stealing all this stuff.
That's right.
You know, your proverbial mafias that we would watch on TV, or, you know, cartels, and, you know, that's fascinating, but those would be your organized crime syndicates. So guess, you know, that's high level.
That's right. And in my reports, I got direct quotes from Target executives and from local law enforcement who are basically acknowledging that it was never really about public safety. It was more about the appearance of safety, right? There's a quote from a Target report where they're talking about the ick factor of how they conducted focus groups and surveys with downtown businesses and downtown people that work downtown, and a lot of the folks that they surveyed were talking about you know, street populations that made them uncomfortable. Not these weren't people who were saying that they were victimized by crime or by criminals. These were people who worked downtown who were just uncomfortable seeing panhandlers on the street. They were uncomfortable seeing Black youth roaming the streets. And so this mass surveillance project that became known as Safe City, it was about going after nuisance violations, right? So I mentioned, you know, how I work with a lot of the young people that were on the Downtown 100 list. These young men were telling me that they were being arrested for spitting on the ground, you know, for littering, right? And so these young men who were on the Downtown 100 list, that list was funneled into another list, which was known as the geographic restriction list. And so this is where the name of my report comes from. The name of my report, 21st Century Jim Crow in the North Star City, was really named after this geographic restriction list. And what a geographic restriction is basically Target was pushing to banish the so-called top offenders in downtown Minneapolis from being downtown, and they sold it to the public as diversion, right? So instead of locking you up, instead of throwing you in jail, we're just going to trespass you from being downtown for 1 year, right? And by doing that, you know, we're reducing recidivism, we're saving someone from going to jail, and they sold it as a win-win. Now, again, as we start to unpack that more, you see that some of these people were on this list not because of the crimes they committed, but because of police harassment. Because once police see them downtown, they began to monitor
them. Contact, right? As you said, you're on the list not because of arrest, but because of police contact.
That's right. That's right. Before we close out, I just want to share. So I talked to a Target insider, who had access to Target's CEO at the time, who was Robert Ulrich. Robert Ulrich was he was the guy. He was Dayton's, the president of the Dayton's Corporation, which Target was under its umbrella. So Target was founded by the Dayton's department store, the Dayton's family, in around 2000, 2001. You know, Dayton's and a lot of these big chain retail department stores started to go under. And Target, the discount retailer, became the head of the corporation. So Target was incorporated around 2000, and it became the center of this franchise, this, you know, franchise. Wow. Going back almost 100 years. And so Robert Ulrich, the CEO, who was head of Dayton's, became the CEO of Target Corporation. He was the one who facilitated the whole Safe City, Safe Zone surveillance project, and its surveillance partnership with police and prosecutors. And so this person that I interviewed, who was close to Robert Ulrich and other folks within Target leadership, told me that Robert Ulrich was a staunch racist, that he was known within Target's leadership for casually using the N-word, about black men hanging out downtown outside of its Target stores. And they told me very matter-of-factly that Target, that Ulrich, his partnership, his closeness with police and prosecutors really helped in his racism and his politics, his right-wing politics, really helped shape the policies of this surveillance program. A lot of the practices, you know, that we see Target using is being used by most retailers, you know, the massive collection of data on its customers, but none of them have the technology as sophisticated as Target. Target is really top tier. They're on a level of their own, and mm-hmm. most of these retailers do not have the partnerships with law enforcement and prosecutors that Target does. We don't see Walmart funding your local prosecutor's office or your local city attorney's office. So Target really is on a whole nother level.
And when you say funding, you're talking about like, here's some equipment, here's some resources, which is very different than funding a campaign.
That's right. Yeah. They're providing free training for law enforcement. They were actually paying for prosecutors in the city account, the county attorney's office and the city attorney's office. So again, you know, Target is setting the parameters for local law enforcement here in Minneapolis, and I suspect they're doing it in other cities as well. But as far as reaching out to me, I'm on Twitter. People can find me. My handle is the People Power Podcast on Twitter. You could check out my reporting at www.unicornriot.ninja. I'm on Instagram as well. I'm not as active on Instagram. My handle on Instagram is at PopsMC, PopsEmcee. And thank you so much, Davey, for having me on your show and facilitating this conversation.
On us, we're doing no wrong, marked and mapped like we don't belong. They paint us guilty and twist the frame, but we're here and on point and set to expose their game. We ain't gonna be no target. We ain't gonna be no target. Never, ever gonna be a target. Not today, baby.
No, 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 not today. No, 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 not today. No, 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 not today. No, no, not today. No, 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 not today.
Crime that schemes built on fear, frame the innocent, shed no tear, prosecute the poor, let the real crooks slide, profit off pain.
Talking about the environment and climate change really hits home with many people. Tune into KBOO on April 22nd at 6 p.m. for Four Walls for Us All. Join us in an exploration of safe, affordable housing, policy, and the passion to go beyond typical solutions to climate change. Learn how to feel more connected and empowered to protect Mother Earth and our fellow human beings in a way that's accessible to everyone. You won't want to miss it. That's Four Walls for Us All on April 22nd at 6 p.m. only on KBOO.
This is Bird Note. Great-tailed grackles live up to their name. The glossy black males trail their long, V-shaped tails behind them as they fly, almost like a plane towing a banner ad. And while not quite as flashy, the brown-feathered females have impressively long tails too. The males settle disputes by fanning their tails. But if the feathers aren't enough to intimidate their rival, a wrestling match ensues. Also known as the Mexican grackle, this species lives in all sorts of habitats, from the northern coasts of South America to the western U.S. They keep their nests secure in tall trees, sometimes over 60 feet high. Their ability to live in both cities and farmland has helped great-tailed grackles expand as far north as Iowa. But they're still more abundant in Central America and southern Texas, where their cacophony of calls helps create the local soundscape. Great-tailed grackles rattle, screech, whistle, and creak, sounding more machine than bird at times. And grackles are fond of gathering in flocks of thousands. Adding all those squeaks and clicks together creates a symphony unlike any other. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
This is Bird Note. some birds are very well known. A few are even legendary. The ancient Greeks and Egyptians described a mythical bird called the phoenix, a magnificent creature that was a symbol of renewal and rebirth. According to legend, each phoenix lived for 500 years, and only one phoenix lived at a time. Just before its time was up, the phoenix built a nest and set itself on fire. Then, a new phoenix would rise from the ashes. Both the Greeks and Egyptians associated the phoenix with the sun. One myth says the dawn song of the phoenix was so beautiful, the sun god Apollo would stop his chariot and the sun to listen. Ancient sources differ on the bird's size and color. Some say it was the size of an eagle, others bigger than an ostrich, with bright red and gold, or maybe even purple feathers. All agree it definitely had a golden aura, and in every version it was exotic, literally one of a kind. Poet Wallace Stevens imagined the mythical gold-feathered bird perched in a palm tree. He wrote, "The bird sings, its feathers shine. The palm stands on the edge of space. The wind moves slowly in the branches. The bird's fire-fangled feathers dangle down." For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Tune into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Welcome to KBOO. I want to see you grow.
Welcome to KBOO. I'm Michael Van